Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Amy Gottlieb of the American Friends Service Committee, who talks about Donald Trump's executive orders imposing new draconian immigration policies and what people can do to support immigrants during this crisis. Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal, chair of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies at the University of California, who warns that Trump's pardon of 1,500 January 6 insurrectionists has emboldened them to commit future acts of political violence. And Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen, who explains why her group and others launched a lawsuit against Donald Trump and Elon Musk's DOGE Government Efficiency Advisory Group. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Mega-billionaire Elon Musk has enthusiastically endorsed Germany's far-right anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party, currently running second in national polls and threatening to break into mainstream politics in the upcoming February 23rd election. After Musk made what was seen as a Nazi salute during Trump's inauguration celebrations, he's appeared twice via video link at AfD rallies in eastern Germany. According to Reuters, Musk praised the AfD, saying he was proud of German culture, German values, and the nation would lose its identity due to multiculturalism. Musk told the right-wing crowd it should not feel guilty about the sins of the past committed by their parents or grandparents. Because of the AfD's anti-democracy positions and their politicians' extremist right-wing rhetoric, they're widely criticized as a neo-fascist party. In May 2024, AfD leader Maximilian Krah was forced to resign after he told journalists that Nazi SS members weren't automatically criminals. In advance of next month's election, mainstream conservatives are feeling the heat from the AfD and are pledging to enact harsh new anti-immigrant policies to appeal to far-right voters. Despite a massive computer hack last fall and the assassination of its CEO, Brian Thompson, in early December, UnitedHealthcare reported $400 billion in revenue in 2024 and $35 billion in profits. On Capitol Hill, United Health employs over 50 lobbyists, including former top staffers to congressional Democrats and Republicans. In 2024, United Health paid nearly $6 million to lobbyists who fiercely oppose any legislation that would force insurers and pharmacy benefit managers to reveal information about artificially inflated sky-high drug prices. In a pre-election report, the national activist group People's Action blasted the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 governance blueprint, now being implemented by Trump across the entire government. The new administration's favorable treatment of the privatized Medicare Advantage option would double profits for United Health and AARP's co-branded Advantage plan. The report estimates that in 2025, United Health will deny at least 5.2 million of their policyholders' health insurance claims. Only hours before Reverend Martin Luther King Day events began, embattled New York City Mayor Eric Adams, who faces federal charges on 5 corruption counts, abruptly canceled his King Day appearances and joined the celebration at Donald Trump's inauguration in Washington. The next day, Adams sat down for an hour-long interview with Trump's pal and right-wing talk show host, Tucker Carlson. Only days earlier, Adams met with Trump at his Mar-a-Lago resort with Manhattan real estate developer Steve Witkoff, Trump's Middle East envoy. There's speculation that Adams, who faces a crowded field of opponents in New York City's Democratic mayoral primary this spring, is seeking a pardon from Trump as he publicly attacks former President Biden on immigration policy. Brad Lander, the city comptroller and a mayoral candidate, said that Adam should be putting as much energy into solving problems like homelessness as he is putting into seeking a pardon. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Donald Trump began his foray into politics in 2015 by demonizing immigrants, labeling them as drug dealers, criminals, and rapists. His strategy of falsely blaming migrants of color as the cause of most of America's problems resonated with many voters, electing him president in 2016 and sending him back to the White House in 2024. Now back in power, Trump is fulfilling his campaign promise to launch the biggest mass deportation of undocumented immigrants in U.S. history. Among the many executive orders issued in his first week, Trump has closed down the U.S. southern border, enlisted the military to assist in the crackdown on immigrants, threatened to prosecute state and local officials who refuse to cooperate with ICE, lifted restrictions on immigration raids in schools, hospitals, and houses of worship, suspended refugee admissions, and attempted to end birthright citizenship that's enshrined in the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Your reporter spoke with Amy Gottlieb, U.S. Migration Director with the American Friends Service Committee, who describes the impact of some of Trump's executive orders imposing new draconian immigration policies and what people can do to support immigrants during this time of crisis.
The shutting down of the southern border, sending down of troops, The refusal of allowing people to come in and even request protection is leading to massive crises at the border, which is also going to lead to increased criminal activity, right? Like the actors that are seeking to profit off of migration are now going to have many more chances. So that's one aspect of it, the attacking of the border. And the truth is that, all of the rhetoric that we heard in the presidential campaign about immigrants, about how we have to, they're using language of invasion, and that's actually in the executive orders that we are being invaded. So we have an extraordinary amount of work to do to help people understand that the invasion that we're seeing is an invasion of people who don't believe that rights should be respected across the board. So, there's no invasion that we need to be protecting ourselves from with having the military at the border. We have a global, worldwide phenomenon of migration, that people move to seek safety, to seek protection, to seek better opportunities, to seek refuge from climate disasters. Many people are stopped on their way here, right? They're just trying to get in and they're stopped now. And so we are completely reneging on our commitment as a nation that welcomes immigrants. We've also suspended the refugee program. So people who had flights booked to come in, who've gone through years of a refugee vetting process, are now not able to enter the United States. And that includes people from Afghanistan who've been waiting for years to come in, people that we have committed to, people who served as interpreters for U.S. troops in Afghanistan are now denied the opportunity to come in because they've shut down the refugee program. So those are some. But then, of course, there's the mass deportations that they talked about, that they threatened, that we've seen all over the news. They really are increasing the numbers. We heard that each ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office, now has a 75-person per day arrest quota. Each office has to bring in 75 people. So what does that look like on the ground? I mean, it's tearing people away from their families. It's tearing people away from their communities. And what we know for so many years of doing this work is that where communities are not feeling secure, stable, able to be together, able to build their families, able to make a living, that's where communities become more fragile, right? And things fall apart. And frankly, what the economic impact will be of these deportations is extraordinary. They're throwing out numbers like the actual cost to deport people is over $80 billion. Right? That's what it's going to cost us to send out ICE agents to make arrests, to detain people, to send people back. Billions of dollars that could be otherwise spent towards education, healthcare, housing, so many things that would benefit our communities. I feel really, really good about the resistance that we're seeing. I mean, lawsuits have been filed. There's already been one court decision on one of the birthright citizenship lawsuits where the judge said, you know, the executive order was blatantly unconstitutional. So the courts are going to be tied up. People are going to be really busy. And we have heard reports of kids not going to school now and neighborhoods being empty. Stores are empty. So there's going to be economic impact in so many ways that we are going to have to be able to resist.
Please review for our listeners what your organization recently wrote about, and that's 6 ways to support immigrants right now in this time of crisis.
You know, there are things that you can be doing immediately, right? I mean, one is we believe strongly that even though we know that it's going to be difficult to get any positive legislation passed, policymakers still need to hear from us. So we have an action alert on our website, which is www.afsc.org, where you can send a letter to your members of Congress asking them to stop deportations. We also have an action alert that's pushing for a fair pathway to citizenship for people who've been here for a long time. So we have materials on our website that can help you kind of understand how to have hard conversations, how to talk about immigration issues with your family, with your friends. You can attend a rally or a vigil or something in your community to show support. You can also, AFSC is hosting webinars on the third Tuesday of every month. Our theme is really protect, resist, and build. We're going to ensure to protect communities that we're in. We're going to resist the policies, and we're going to build toward the vision of the world that we want to see.
That was Amy Gottlieb, U.S. Migration Director with the American Friends Service Committee. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's oppressive and cruel immigration policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the first week Donald Trump returned to the White House, he followed through on dozens of campaign pledges, many detailed in the Heritage Foundation's infamous Project 2025 that the twice-impeached president had earlier disavowed. Executive orders he issued included the launch of mass deportations of undocumented immigrants, the mass firing of civil servants, including 18 inspectors general across government agencies, eliminating federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and what appeared to be an unconstitutional freeze on all government loans and grants. Most alarmingly, Trump pardoned some 1,500 convicted January 6 insurrectionists, many of whom were found guilty of violent attacks against Capitol police officers. Trump also commuted the sentences of 14 Oath Keepers and Proud Boy militia leaders sentenced to long prison terms, some for the crime of seditious conspiracy. Many Republican legislators and Vice President J.D. Vance had expressed opposition to granting pardons to those January 6 insurrectionists that attacked police. But after Trump announced the blanket pardons, most were either silent or publicly supported the president, contradicting their earlier positions. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal, chair and lead researcher with the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies at the University of California at Berkeley, who discusses how these pardons have eroded the rule of law and emboldened the insurrectionists to commit future acts of political violence targeting Trump's perceived enemies.
I think there's no way around looking at the pardons as close to an invitation to greater political violence. It's very hard to put a happier picture on it than that. During the election campaign, we had General Milley and General Kelly explicitly calling Donald Trump a fascist. That kind of thinking goes way back, you know, to the 1930s, Wilhelm Reich, 1950s, the authoritarian personality and so forth, in which you talk about an individual as a fascist personality. What's not talked about, which is now kind of implicated is not a fascist personality, but a fascist movement. It seems to me that the defining characteristic of a fascist movement is the marriage between an electoral party and a private militia. Is that what we have now? Are the Proud Boys, let's say, what is their relationship now to the Republican Party? I think it's quite ambiguous. You know, back in the 2020 campaign, in a debate with then Compassmentist Joe Biden, Trump referred to or stated addressing the militias, stand back and stand by. And immediately on the internet, from people like the head of the Proud Boys, you got back, yes, sir, immediately, as though they recognized Trump as their commander. Trump was at that time the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces, but it turned out, in some respect, he was the commandante of the American right-wing militias. That now has been, that relationship has been confirmed by letting these people out of jail. And so the question of the relationship of a private militia, which is prepared to engage in violence, to this electoral party, which is in power, is a question of the gravest urgency, in as much as I suggest, it is the very definition or the very defining characteristic of a fascist party. So we're talking about the difference between what Milley and Kelly talked about, a fascist personality, versus a fascist movement, which is yet a further disturbing, at the very least, factor.
Dr. Rosenthal, is it not also possible, because of these pardons and the green light many of these armed insurrectionists feel they have now from the president, that on the other end of the political spectrum, there are people and groups who may feel it necessary to begin arming themselves to defend against right-wing militia groups embraced by Donald Trump? Could this not spiral out of control?
I can tell you my immediate and most significant reaction is that's what the right-wing militias want. The dress rehearsal for January 6th was Charlottesville. That was August of 2017. You had the nighttime parade with torches. You had someone killed, and you had chanting, "You will not replace us, Jews will not replace us," and "Blood and soil," which is a straightforward old Nazi chant. What was Charlottesville? It called itself the Unite the Right rally. And what it was an attempt to create a united right-wing national militia. That's what was intended to be united in the Unite the Right rally. The person most well-known in organizing that, back then we talked about, if you remember, the alt-right. The person who is reputed to have given the name alt-right to that movement was somebody called Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer, at the time, kind of waxed poetic about it is time for fighting in the streets and to dominate the streets. He explicitly talked about the moment in America resembled Weimar Germany, that is to say the period before the rise of or the coming to power of the Nazi Party. And what he was talking about was fighting in the streets. And that is an end of the right-wing militias. It is the thing they would most like to see happen. So whether it creates a left-wing response, that may or may not happen. But if it does, it is in a historic manner playing into the hands of the likes of Stuart Rhodes, head of the Oath Keepers.
That was Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal, chair and lead researcher with the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies at the University of California, and author of the book titled Empire of Resentment, Populism's Toxic Embrace of Nationalism. Find more news and commentary on Trump's pardon of January 6th insurrectionists by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After his election victory in November, Donald Trump announced the creation of what he called a Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Trump said the advisory group, which is not an official government department, would provide recommendations to slash excess regulations, cut wasteful expenditures, and restructure federal agencies. Billionaires Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, chosen to lead the group, said they aim to cut $2 trillion in annual federal spending. Four lawsuits were quickly filed against DOGE, the first filed by Public Citizen, with its two co-presidents, Lisa Gilbert and Robert Weisberg, seeking to be included in the commission to make it more balanced. After Ramaswamy left DOGE to run for Ohio governor, Musk is now the group's sole leader, who has a multitude of conflicts of interest since his various companies have billions of dollars in contracts with the federal government. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Public Citizen's Lisa Gilbert about why her group filed their lawsuit and their end goal in challenging Trump's cost-cutting advisory commission.
It is an external entity with tentacles that are reaching into the government. So, you know, people positioned in specific government agencies, but advising from the outside primarily, helmed by Elon Musk, obviously a billionaire with no particular government experience. And the idea is to cut regulations that they deem are burdensome, primarily to industry, and slash government spending. You know, so things that are, to some, might seem in the pursuit of efficiency, but from our perspective, what they'll be cutting, the types of things they want to do away with, are things that actually protect regular Americans from wrongdoing companies and the richest among us, things that would hurt regular people. And at the end of the day, really have the potential to transfer massive amounts of wealth to the richest class, which of course Musk is a part of. So not something that we think is helpful, not really the way to pursue efficiency, and hugely problematic.
You sent out a letter, you and your co-president, I guess to President Trump, suggesting that it might be a good idea to include the two of you in this effort. So tell me about that. When did you send that? And did you get a response?
On January 13th, we sent a letter to Trump transition co-chairs, Howard Lutnick, Linda McMahon, with our belief that they are not complying with the Federal Advisory Committee Act. We think that the entity they're setting up, DOGE, is clearly a federal advisory committee, which means that they have to have balanced participation. And being helmed by a billionaire and staffed by tech bros, in our perspective, is not balanced. And myself and my co-president, Robert Weissman, with our long track record of expertise on rulemaking and deep service to the public, would provide a very different perspective. So, you know, we requested that we become a part of DOGE. We have not yet gotten a response, although a similar request that came from a colleague organization of ours that is actually a co-filer in our lawsuit against DOGE, States Defending Democracy Fund, did get a response, which was, we have no room in our administration for Democrats.
So you had some suggestions, though, for where you could find a lot of cuts to the budget that would make it more efficient and not hurt regular people. Can you talk about some of those?
Our sense is that, you know, if one was truly thinking about fixing our government, thinking about efficiency as something that helps regular people, there are lots of things that you could do. You could think about ending privatized Medicare, for example, or Senator Sanders also recommended reducing the wasteful Pentagon budget. you could cut fossil fuel subsidies or reduce drug prices. There actually is a huge set of smart public investments that you could make that would make our government more efficient and save money at the same time. But this is not what we expect with the current ideological bent of DOGE. We expect instead that they will be thinking about cutting programs and policies that we all care about, whether we're talking about the Department of Education or Meals on Wheels or SNAP benefits. You know, the types of cuts that we expect are not things that will make the lives of regular Americans better.
I know that in Trump's first administration, he was really disorganized. He had actually appointed people who took the job to try to, rein him in, which they were quite successful at doing in some regards. So now, with Project 2025, they're just following the playbook to basically rewrite government and, as you said, make it serve even more the oligarchs and the tech bros and Trump's own family. So, what is your lawsuit aimed to do?
Yeah, I mean, our lawsuit, which we filed jointly with AFGE, Government Employees Union, and States Defenders Democracy Fund, as I mentioned, simply says that, you know, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency must comply with the requirements of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. Despite its name, DOGE is not a department of the United States government, as announced by Donald Trump and as reinforced in the executive action they issued on day one. This is an entity that will be advising. And so there are a number of requirements that go along with having a federal advisory committee. You have to have a fair balance of viewpoints. You have to have meetings that are held in public and with public notice. You need to have publicly transparent records and work product. So all of these requirements are things that, if not happening, make DOGE in violation of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So we are suing on those grounds.
That was Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen. Learn more about the legal challenges to Trump's DOGE cost-cutting commission by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky and Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KSER in Everett, Washington, Progressive Voices Network nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.